We still have our eyes on the World Cup soccer tournament, but there is big news this week in what is still the most watched sport in the United States, American football. This week, a judge approved a preliminary settlement between the NFL and retired players that would give between $1.5 and $5 million to those suffering from the long-term effects of concussions. The deal also removes a $675 million cap on total payouts from the league, something that caused the same judge to reject an earlier version of the plan back in January. The court estimates that some 20,000 retired players will be eligible. We wanted to get a better idea of what this means for the health of current and retired players, so we're joined once again by Damaris Smith. He is the executive director of the National Football League Players Association. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And for additional perspective, we've also called Jason Breslow. He is a digital reporter at the investigative news program Frontline, and he's been covering concussions in the NFL since 2012. Jason, welcome to you as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Mr. Smith, let me start with you. What are you hearing from current and former players about this settlement?
Well, I think what you have seen in the media from particularly former players is a bit of relief that the settlement has been approved. There are continuing questions about what exactly is covered, what qualifies as a qualifying injury for compensation. But I think for every former player, the key here is to make sure that they understand what the settlement is and make a prudent decision about whether they want to opt in or not. We are not parties to the lawsuit.
So, Jason, at the center of this case are former players who feel that the league did not prepare them or their families for the consequences of concussions. We spoke with former New Orleans Saints player Kyle Turley, describing what he saw as a lack of medical care after he was knocked out once during practice. And this is what he told us.
To release me to my wife, to only have my wife be completely terrified and have to find somebody to take us to the hospital because she doesn't know what to do with me. And then I'm back playing football after a hospital stay overnight and back at practice full tilt, 100%, full pads, hitting to test and whether or not I'm good to go.
So, Jason, what about that? I mean, is that consistent with what you heard from other players over the course of your reporting?
Certainly. I think there's a lot of frustration among players out there that while they were in the league, that they never got good enough information from the NFL about the long-term implications of concussions and repeated hits to the head. And then players who retired from the league, increasingly frustrated at their inability to get any assistance from the NFL. I think the concerns that Kyle Turley just voiced are very common among the roughly 4,500 players in the NFL concussion suit.
You've been trying to document this over the course of a couple of seasons. And one of the things that your reporting indicated is that there's still a question of how brain injury is actually reported. I mean, you say that a third of all concussions are left off the NFL injury report. Now, why is that?
Well, it really comes down to how the league issues its injury report. One thing that we found is during the preseason and during training camp, none of the concussions that take place end up on a league injury report. Now, that's not the case during the regular season. If a player goes down with a head injury during the regular season, he'll show up on an injury report the next week. That doesn't happen during the preseason. And as a result of that, you know, it makes it really difficult to tell exactly how widespread the problem is and also to tell how quickly players are returning from all of their injuries.
What about that, Mr. Smith? Are you satisfied with the reporting, that the reporting on the actual brain injury that players are exposed to is fully documented?
Yeah. Well, look, my job as the head of the union is to never be satisfied. Mm-hmm. Our goal is to make sure that we are always better tomorrow than we were today. Are things better? Yes. We have mandatory protocols for when a player has suffered a traumatic brain injury. We have unaffiliated or independent sideline concussion experts. There are mandated protocols for return to play. But all of those things depend on doctors, players, and coaches adhering to the protocols. So can we always do a better job of reporting? Absolutely. But are things better? Yes. Are we satisfied with it? Never.
Do players have recourse if they feel that they've experienced a traumatic brain injury that isn't officially documented in the injury report?
Yes. Mm-hmm. A player, and we stress that a player has an independent duty to maintain and monitor his own health. If that player is not satisfied with the medical care that he has received, obviously he can contact his union, but he can also take steps to refer himself to a independent neurologist at no cost to the player. So what we've tried to do is, one, make sure that there are mandatory rules for everyone in the business of football to follow, but certainly to remain vigilant to make sure that those rules are applied fairly.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the NFL concussion settlement. Our guests are Damaris Smith, executive director of the National Football League Players Association, and Jason Breslow, who's been reporting on this issue for the investigative news series Frontline. And part of the settlement, Jason, says that players will receive different amounts depending on their age and the severity of their cognitive impairment. Based on your reporting, are there good assessment tools for evaluating that? And are the, do the players think those assessment tools are fair?
I think there's a fair bit of concern among the players in the case. I mean, just last week, for example, a group of seven players filed a motion in court, in the Philadelphia court with U.S. District Judge Anita Brody, saying that the concussion settlement was, the way they put it, was a lousy deal for former players. I think that's one of the main concerns, is how will the league be able to track players' injuries once they retire from the league. One of the things that players are concerned about is that although the league has said it will award players in the lawsuit for very specific diagnoses such as dementia or Lou Gehrig's disease, these players are worried that broader symptoms of these diseases, such as depression or memory loss or kind of debilitating headaches, might not qualify them for awards from the league later on down the road.
And actually, the family members are also concerned. We spoke with Eleanor Perfetto. She's the widow of a former player who died of complications from dementia. She says that the impact of the injuries is a lot broader than is perhaps immediately obvious. I just want to play a short clip of what she told us.
It's the spouse who's going to bear the burden of this in the years to come. The spouse who is going to be the one that's going to be feeding that person every day, bathing that person, taking them to the bathroom. You know, the money sounds like it's awfully good, but there reaches a point where there just isn't enough money to compensate for the physical and emotional pain and strain that that family is going to go through.
If that is the case, though, Mr. Smith, what would you respond to families who say that they still aren't sure if they're going to have enough money to take care of their loved ones in the years to come?
You know, I think any lawyer would tell prospective people who want to opt into that settlement to make very careful decisions about whether you want to opt in, how you are covered, how the analysis or qualitative analysis of the illness will be done, and then to make a prudent decision about whether you want to participate in this settlement. I mean, look, the key here for every former player and every spouse and every family member for this settlement is to make a prudent and careful decision about whether you want to opt into this or not. Remember, this was a class action case. The union is not a member. We don't provide legal advice.
Jason, do you have a final thought about the current sort of iteration of the settlement based on the reporting that you've done so far?
Well, I think one thing that is worth noting is while the NFL certainly made great strides in changing its rules, one hurdle that still kind of remains is kind of getting over this warrior mentality that a lot of players still have when it comes to being out there on the field, playing hurt, playing through injuries. One, they feel like they want to be out there, they want to play hurt, they don't want to let their teammates down. But there's also a financial incentive in that they, if they're not out there, they run the risk of being cut from the team and being out of a job. So I think that's a hurdle that still kind of needs to be addressed.
Mm. Gee, final thought?
You know, look, we will always be in a world where players will want to play. The goal isn't so much, I think, to question the warrior mentality. You know, one of the words that I hate in this business is for anyone to refer to players as gladiators. They're not. What we try to do is to make sure that players understand the risk, holding doctors accountable to give the right level of treatment, holding coaches accountable, holding players accountable, holding the National Football League accountable.
Recognizing that, as you said several times, that the Players Association was not a party to this particular suit, which was brought by a group of former players, if we were to get together, say, 5 years from now, mm-hmm. to assess whether they as a group are better off than they are now, better cared for, their overall
better
quality
treatment.
Of life, better treatment, their quality mm-hmm. of life is better, what do you think the answer will be?
My hope is the answer is yes. I mean, one major change in the world of the former players who were parties to the lawsuit and players today is there are no more two-a-day practices during training camp. Players now only can have contact 1 day a week during the course of the season. There is a longer off-season for rest and recovery. Do we know more scientifically now than we did? Yes. But one critical factor continues to be one that concerns us is the use of pain-killing drugs. Do we have to continue to monitor that and make sure that it's not masking traumatic brain injuries and or in some other way exacerbating injuries that are already there? Yes. Is the hope that 5 years from now, will the quality of life of our current players be better? Yes, I do believe it will. But it will only be better if we remain vigilant as a union and responsible as a league.
Doris Smith is the executive director of the National Football League Players Association. He was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Jason Breslow was also with us. He's a digital associate at the investigative news show Frontline. He was with us from Boston. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now it's time for a visit to the beauty shop where our panel of women journalists and commentators take a fresh cut on the week's news. Sitting in the chairs for a new do this week are Kelly Goff. She's a columnist for TheRoot.com and The Daily Beast. Veronica Miller is a contributor to XO Jane and The Griot. Alexis Wilkinson is a student at Harvard University and president of the Harvard Lampoon. That's the school's undergraduate humor magazine. And Prachi Gupta is an assistant editor at Salon.com where she covers entertainment news. Welcome to you all. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Hello.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
So let's start with a conversation that we seem to have, I don't know, every couple of months or so. Maybe it's every couple of weeks. I'm talking about the Can Women Have It All discussion. This time it was sparked by the CEO, I know, right, of PepsiCo, Indra Nooyi. She made comments at the Aspen Ideas Festival. She was being interviewed by the president of The Atlantic, David Bradley, and he asked her, can women have it all? And she talks about what happened when she came home early one night, early for her, with good news about a big promotion. And before she could get a word out, she says that her mom demanded that she go get some milk because they were out, even though she said Nooyi's husband had been home for hours. Let's listen to a short clip.
I said, I had great news for you. I've just been told that I'm going to be president on the board of directors, and all that you want me to do is to go out and get the milk. What kind of a mom are you? And she said to me, let me explain something to you. You might be president of PepsiCo, you might be on the board of directors, but when you enter this house, you're the wife, you're the daughter, you're the daughter-in-law, you're the mother, you're all of that. Nobody else can take that place. So leave that damn crown in the garage.
Well, you know, got a big reaction, both in the hall and on social media afterwards. And yesterday we talked about this with a panel of moms in our parenting conversation, but I wanted to raise this with people who have different family lives and just get your reaction to this, particularly from people who are, let's say, a little younger than Indra Nooyi and myself. And so, Prachi, I'm going to start with you because you said that you are also Indian American, as is Indra Nooyi. She's a naturalized American citizen born in India. You said her comments kind of really pierced you as an Indian American young woman. Do you want to tell us a little bit more?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm sad that the message that she took away from this is that she can't have it all because she's a woman, not because she's in the very demanding position of a CEO. But yeah, as an Indian woman, I can really understand why she'd feel that way. She's trying to straddle two different cultures. On the one hand, show her kids growing up in America what an independent woman looks like, but also trying to seek the approval and exist within a culture that values very traditional gender roles for women. And I think that she's broken a lot of barriers, but she can't break every barrier on her own.
You feel like there's like a, what's the phrase that you use, like dual expectations that don't actually always match up, right? And what are those?
Sure. I think there's definitely a double standard for what a good mom looks like, especially in the Indian culture. I think patriarchy is, I mean, I think American cultures are familiar with that concept too. But, you know, in the traditional Indian culture, women from Nui's generation and before her generation were really raised with the idea that you'll have an arranged marriage and you'll live in a house that will of your husband's house, and you'll assume to take the role of, you know, doing a lot of cooking and cleaning. And I think that that's a hard culture to break out of or explain when you're straddling two different cultures like she is.
Mm. Kelly Goff, what do you think? How did you respond to this?
Well, the comments, I mean, those comments were obviously, it struck a chord with me like they did with, I think, every woman who heard them. But the comments that really struck a chord with me were the ones where she talked about her, how she didn't know that her daughters would say she was a great mom. And, you know, and so when I went on to read the rest of the article, and I don't want to take up everyone's time, mm-hmm. it's worth a read for those who haven't heard it. But there was a particular moment she talked about when her daughters call her office and how she has instructions for her assistant about what to say to them when it comes to various different scenarios they might call about. And that touched me because, you know, I have a really close relationship with my mom, as you've probably caught on since I mentioned her probably every single interview I've ever done here. And part of that relationship comes from the fact that when I was little, there was a rule about me checking in and calling her office on a regular basis. So she knew I was safe and knew what homework the situation was. And that's lasted through adulthood. So my point is, I read this article, I read the comments, and I didn't think, you know, Indra Nui is someone I want as my mother. I'm going to be honest. But I also am so happy, Michelle, that we have her as a role model in terms of corporate America. And so for me, the takeaway from this is I actually was thrilled she said all of this out loud, because I would love to see more women do what men have felt comfortable doing for centuries, which is saying the following. You know, I don't know that I was the world's best father, but I'm a damn good senator. I'm a damn good CEO. I sacrificed a lot in my personal life so that the country could be better, etc. Which is something, remember, in the Can We Have It All article Slaughter did, she said that Holbrooke's son said he wasn't there at my baseball games because he was out saving the world. Mm. I don't think anyone thought we wish he wasn't saving the world. I just wish it was allowable for more women to say, I made some sacrifices here, and that doesn't make me a bad person.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering why a person with that income doesn't have a housekeeper who's willing to go get that milk. I'm sorry, no offense, but I mean, if I had that salary, trust me, I'd be having
never
like,
get my own milk.
Some milk delivered. Peapod, anybody heard of it?
Fresh Direct.
They'll come
Fresh
to your
direct.
House. So there's that. What about you, Alexis?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what was just said. I think that sort of can women have it all is such a dumb way to phrase that question, because it's like, can women have everything they've ever wanted, or are they normal human beings who have to make sacrifices, you know? Like, life isn't zero sum. Nobody can have it all. The question is whether we can have it all, but why we're not okay with or are made to feel bad about only having enough. Like, why isn't it just enough that I'm a really good, you know, I have a good career, or why isn't it enough that I'm a really good mom? And also, it really bothered me when she said she wasn't sure if her daughters would think she was a good mom, because I had a single working mother who worked full time, and I knew that she did that so that the light stayed on. You know, I was grateful and proud that my mom wasn't a housewife like other moms, and maybe it's a cultural thing or something, but I would have never berated my mom for not being at the PTA or whatever, or something like that. It wouldn't have gone over too well. and you know, I just think that basically nobody can have it all, not women, not children, not men, nobody. Mm-hmm. And so it's just deciding what you value. And obviously Nui has made that choice, and she and other women should stop feeling guilty about it, you know, and also let their daughters know that, listen, you know, your dad isn't at the PTA either. Why don't you go yell at him about that?
Yeah, well, how about that? When you said cultural, Alexis, what do you mean? You mean the fact that you're African-American, you think it was, but did most of your friends' parents work, moms work? And do you think that made a difference? Maybe that, you know what I mean? When you said that, what were you thinking?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, in the sense that, like, most of my friends who had, especially if you have a single mother, like, she's working. How else are you alive, you know? And it wasn't something you could ever hold over, you know, her head saying that, you know, you should be doing what these other moms who don't have to work could do. And I think also just my mom really instilled in me the idea of being independent, and that, you know, my father passed away when I was a toddler, and you know, she has a graduate degree, and she had done everything right, but sort of the idea that you still might have to end up taking care of yourself and everybody else around you, so be prepared to do that. Mm. And again, that was something that I was proud of and, you know, held in my heart as something I wanted to do when I got older.
Veronica, what about you? What are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I think Alexis just actually just read my mind, because I was having this conversation this morning, and the fact is no one, man or woman, can have it all. You know, my dad was the one who was the breadwinner in our household, but he was the one that had to make the hard choices because he wanted to raise a family. And so he was the one who had to, you know, choose to forego a job opportunity or choose to forego moving to another city for, you know, better income because he wanted to keep his family, you know, grounded. And my fiance is making the same decision right now because we are putting our relationship, making our relationship a priority and the start of our relationship a priority. So he has to pass up things. What's annoying is the fact that no one can have it all, but women are the ones who are expected to choose and whose choices are, you know, put under a microscope or a spotlight and whose choices are judged. And so I agree with everyone else that I wish that, you know, we could accept that no one can really have it all. Human beings have to make sacrifices, and that includes women.
If you're just wise beyond their years, wise beyond their years. Speaking of, if you're just joining us, we're in the beauty shop. We're talking about this week's hot topics with our panel of writers, Kelly Guff, Prachi Gupta, Alexis Wilkinson, and Veronica Miller. And while we're on the subject of weddings, Veronica, she noticed how she just slipped in here, my fiance. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes. Best wishes. Congratulations to you both. But, you know, Kelly, it's so interesting because you wrote a piece for The Root about couples wanting to tie the knot with lavish weddings. And I think a lot of people do know that the marriage rate in this country has declined a great deal in recent generations. And you're wondering, you're speculating whether that could be that these wedding reality shows and this exposure to these kind of over-the-top celebrity weddings has somehow sort of dampen people's desire to get married because they believe that you can't get married unless you have kind of one of these over-the-top experiences. What made you think that?
Well, for one, because there's that new, the data, I was going to call it new, it really came out in 2012, but it's really sort of attracted more a second round of attention in recent months about why the marriage rates are so low, because it's no longer race-specific, which is sort of how it's been talked about in terms of out-of-wedlock births being specific to the Black community, really. It's now specifically across racial lines that marriage and having children within marriage is now one of the greatest class indicators in terms of having a college degree, regardless of race. And that's what's really starting to change. That's what's becoming the reality with Generation Y. And so it's no longer this, you know, black and white of poverty versus no poverty. It's really college degree versus no college degree. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they found in the data is that people are starting to equate the concept of marriage with a capstone, like buying a house. So they're seeing it as like, you know, one of those things that you achieve when you can really afford to and you've ascended to a certain level. And one of the things I noticed in a number of articles about poverty is this phrasing kept coming up. We can't afford to get married. Even when people had multiple children together, they would say, we can't afford to get married. Well, what does that mean, you start to ask, right? Because a city hall wedding doesn't cost a lot. A wedding certificate doesn't cost a lot. And these are people who are supporting their children. And so one of the people that I quoted in my column, who was in a New York Times series on poverty, specifically said, I want my woman deserves the weddings that we see on TV. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. She deserves that. And you look at the cost of weddings last year, and they're almost $30,000. So you know, I don't have a big study to back up that this is the mm-hmm. primary reason, but I do think that you start to wonder that people are seeing marriage as something that can only be achieved once you can, quote, afford to give yourself the wedding of your dreams. And I think that's a real tragedy. I really do, because that's not what marriage is about. It's not about the big party on the big expensive party.
What about that, Veronica? I mean, honestly, do you feel, also partly because you're also in fashion, I just want to mention this as well.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this pressure to have some big do that would be People Magazine worthy?
It's not People Magazine worthy. Okay. Honestly, I want to get married in City Hall. We've started planning. I'm almost ready to throw out all the spreadsheets and just do it. But my family and my fiance's family, if I did it, I'd have to go in hiding. I wouldn't be able to talk to any of you anymore. But it's not so much the People Magazine and the TV shows and things. I think it's the expectations from the people around you. So, you know, almost as soon as in announcing that we got engaged, immediately the questions about what are your colors, what dress are you wearing, where are you getting married, what food are you going to have, you know, all these expectations, the expectations for everyone to be invited, which is another, you know, thing to deal with. It's just everyone has this opinion on what your wedding should be and forgets that it's about you. And so you as the couple have to manage everybody's expectations, but still keep your sanity and still keep your budget in check and still make sure you're doing something that's true to the both of you. And it's just hard trying to manage all those expectations. And especially when you have a huge family like mm-hmm. mine, like my guest list alone is cousins and aunts and uncles and grandparents, all first generation. So it's just, you know, I'm learning to start telling people, I'll figure this out. I will let you know when I figure it out. And until then, we are not going to talk about it.
Hmm. Well, mm-hmm. I'm sure they got a big room at City Hall. I don't know.
Yeah.
community room. But okay, just briefly, though, on this, the Pew Research Center report yesterday found that a lot of millennials and people younger than 35 don't think that marriage and children are a priority. 69% of people aged 18 to 24 that felt that society is just as well off if people have priorities other than marriage and children. That's compared mm-hmm. to 61% of people 25 to 34, 51% of people, older people. Anyway, you can see the kind of a declining sense of the priority of this. And I just mm-hmm. wanted to ask, I don't know, Prachi, do you want to take this, whether that concerns you or not?
Sure. I mean, I wouldn't say that really concerns me. I think it sort of makes sense considering that traditionally, the family model has also changed in that period of time. Originally, that's what you did. Most people couldn't afford an education, and that's what you did. You had a family, and that also started a lot earlier. But now, as we find that the model for people has changed, and more women are also in the workforce. I think that the family model and getting married would change too. So I don't think it's a negative thing. I just think it's a sign of all of those other things changing as well.
Alexis, I have a final question. I want to get your take on this. We only have a couple of minutes left. Mm-hmm. Got to ask you about Joan Rivers, because you are also in comedy, as we've mentioned, president of the Harvard Lampoon. You know, she's known for her kind of biting comments about everybody. Mm-hmm. including herself. And earlier this week, you know, she's promoting this new book, Diary of a Mad Diva. On the cover, she's rocking a fur coat. And so the interviewer, Frederica Whitfield from CNN, asked her some questions about some of these things, and this is what happened. Here it is.
Mm-hmm. You know, this whole interview is becoming a defensive interview.
No!
Are you wearing leather shoes?
Yeah!
And shut up. You know what I mean? I don't want to hear. You're wearing leather shoes.
I'm not an activist,
You're eating chicken.
Yeah.
You're eating meat. I don't want to hear this nonsense. You know, I'm going. I really am going, because all you have done is negative.
No,
I really like the gasp.
No, Freddie Whitfield was quoted as saying she thought she was joking until she actually literally walked out. But I just have to ask, Alexis, what do you make of that? Of her, how she responded to that whole scene.
Oh, Joan. I mean, well, first of all, however you feel about her now, she was and is an icon as a female writer and comedian. You know, she's amazing, and I'm all for comedic license and being able to joke about whatever you want. And if she just wants to sit back and, you know, talk crap about people all day, let her do it. But the problem is you really can't get pissed when someone calls you on the problematic aspects of that. You know, it's an interview, and Joan Rivers, of all people, should be used to people calling her a hypocrite. I mean, the woman makes a living making fun of people's appearances when, you know, she looks like a Dali surrealist painting. Like, you know, getting called on your BS comes with the territory of comedy, and I'm so, like, disappointed that she couldn't just laugh it off. If she had just stayed and was angry the whole time, that would have been so funny. Like, you heard the interviewer laughing. Like, if she was just, like, a, you know, pissed off old lady and was just, you know, being really defensive, that would have been very funny and a great interview, but sort of walking out, you know, that's weak sauce. I'm disappointed in that.
Disappointed as a comedic writer yourself. What do you think? She was having a bad day, or you think that she's just at a point where she thinks she shouldn't have to answer these questions? She can dish it, but can't take it.
Yeah, maybe she's just sick of it.
Uh-huh. Two words: well, publicity stunt.
Oh, okay, could be. That could be.
And it worked. It worked. She got more coverage for this book than her last three books.
Okay, could be. All right, Alexis Wilkinson is a student at Harvard University and president of the Harvard Lampoon, the school's undergraduate humor magazine, with us from Pittsburgh. Veronica Miller is a contributor to XO, Jane, and The Griot. She joined us from Philadelphia. Prachi Gupta is an assistant editor for Salon.com, and Kelly Goff is a columnist for TheRoot.com and The Daily Beast. They were both with us from our bureau in New York. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Usually around this time on Wednesdays, I share some thoughts in my Can I Just Tell You essay. Today, though, I'm handing the mic over to another member of the Tell Me More team, producer Amy Ta. When she's not part of my team putting on a great radio broadcast, she is part of another, a bike racing team. She's an avid cyclist. She'd been biking to work for years, but recently took up racing. But last month, she suffered a serious crash near the end of a 70-mile ride. She suffered a broken jaw and cheekbone and experienced bleeding in her brain. I know I speak for all of us when I tell you the extent of her injuries was frightening. But she is on the mend, and as she recovers, Amy wanted to share what she's learned from the accident, and we are so glad she can now move her jaw enough to tell you herself. Here's her essay.
What got me into that mess? My ego. I had just won a road race the past weekend. It was a very technical course with hairpin turns. After the victory, I wasn't afraid of anything. Sure, you can say I was stupid, reckless. I won't argue with that, but can I just tell you? I didn't believe in limits. My mind always said to keep going and just ignore the pain and fatigue. Suffer now to be stronger later. My body always obeyed. But finally, that one day came when it would not. My brain needed to listen to my body. Stop when the body says stop. That was lesson number one. Lesson number two, I'm actually pretty lucky. The crash could have been way worse. I didn't break my legs, or neck, or spine. I still have my vision, even though my left eye wouldn't open for days afterward. And yes, it was annoying that I couldn't chew food or see my mangled face in the mirror without wanting to cry. It was tough and long, and being trapped inside got me really frustrated. But those were just details. The big picture, I survived. Final lesson, and the most important one, family is everything. Yes, blood family, but I'm also talking about my DC cycling community, NPR colleagues, friends near and far. They all came rushing to offer help, visiting me in the hospital and at home, bringing me food, clothes, and of course the one thing a journalist appreciates, a good story. I got lots of surprises in the mail, even from people I never met in person. Also text messages asking how I was doing and reminders to stay positive. During the lowest point of my recovery, one stood out. Recovery is more difficult than any race, but patience always wins. That kind of love made all the difference. So as for the friends who helped me get through this, I want to tell them, I'd say all your names if I could. There's just no airtime for that. You know who you are. And I want you to know, I'm grateful, and I'm sorry for all the panic and worry that I caused. But I'll make it all up by winning another race for you.
Amy Ta is a Tell Me More producer. We're very happy she's recovering and sending good wishes her way. Now to Brazil, which is still mourning their team's 7-1 defeat against Germany at World Cup yesterday. Despite the loss on the pitch, the country still has many fans off of it, not least because of its rich musical legacy. So we thought it would be worth revisiting our conversation with one of their best-known and most successful stars. Maria Rita has won 7 Latin Grammys. She's sold more than 2.5 million albums. She's also the daughter of two of its renowned artists, Elis Regina, who's been called Brazil's greatest singer, and renowned pianist César Camargo Mariano. Her latest album is an homage to the music her mother made famous with songs like Agua de Março.
É o fim da picada, é a garrafa de cana, estilhaço na estrada, é o projeto da casa, é o corpo na cama, é o carro enguiçado, é a lama, é a lama, é um passo, é uma ponte, é um sapo, é uma rã, é um resto de mato, na luz da manhã, são as águas de março fechando o verão, é a promessa de vida no teu.
When we caught up with her in New York earlier this year, I asked her if she struggled with the weight of her heritage.
Once I realized that I needed to sing, it wasn't something that I would do as a hobby or something that I would do because people expected me to. Once I realized that that was me, you know, it was my soul and was my truth, that whole thing became secondary. Up until the point when I felt ready for the challenge, indeed, it was a pressure. You know, it's hard to not know whether people like you and befriend you because of who you are, because of who your parents or your mother is. And that made me very insecure for a long time. But as I said, once I realized that that was me speaking and not other people, really, honest, I'm being very honest, like it became secondary because that was me. That's what I needed to do.
How did you go about finding your own voice? I remember reading an interview with you from Billboard magazine, and you were quoted as saying, look, our resemblance is genetic, not conscious in matters of music. I hear much more Ella Fitzgerald in me than Elis Regina.
Right. I grew up listening to Ella Fitzgerald. Like, she's my, she's all that. I mean, I can't even start describing. I get goosebumps just by listening to her. She touches me in a way that I can only dream of touching people. I didn't listen to my mom as I was growing up because it was too painful, as it still is somewhat. I mean, you have to understand that this woman was not only the greatest singer ever in Brazil, she was also beautiful, smart, intelligent. She was really involved in all kinds of social and political issues. She was just a pioneer. She was ahead of her time, and she would read a lot, and she was just so mind-boggling, and people were so in love with her. Whoever, from, you know, I'm talking about the audience, I'm talking about the people who worked with her. I've met up with a bunch of musicians who played for her. At one point or another, you know, earlier on the conversation or later in the conversation, they would just look at me, it's like, you know, I have something to tell. And I was like, okay, go ahead. And they would say, I was completely in love with her. I've heard that way too many times because that's the kind of woman that she was. She was just, she would light up the room.
I mean, you certainly more than proved yourself, if indeed you ever felt that you had to in your own right. I mean, I want to mention that you've won more Latin Grammys than any other Brazilian artist, and that includes two for your album Segundo. And this song won Best Brazilian Song. I think it's Camino das Águas. Here it is.
Segue seu rumo lenta, como quem já não quer mais chegar, como quem se acostumou no canto das águas, como quem já não quer mais voltar.
One of my colleagues was walking by my office when I was playing some of your CDs, and she said, wow, that makes me feel like I'm in a warm place.
Na roda canta com o seu
Have you ever desired to work in English?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's really important. The kind of music that I do, the kind of music that I like to present to people is one which they can relate to on a deeper level, you know. Don't just shake your head and your, you know, lap your fingers every now and again. Because I think that music in general does play the role of the soundtrack of one's life. And I find that very seductive in a way, you know, to have someone listen to your music, whether in Portuguese or English or Spanish, because I sing in Spanish as well, and just be like, oh, I'm so glad that someone gets me, and I'm so glad that someone put that into music and put that into words, because oftentimes we feel something, we don't really understand what it is, or we don't really have the words to explain it, but it's right there in the song.
Let me play another song, if you don't mind. This is from your first album, the self-titled Maria Rita, which you released when you were 24. And this is Agora Só Falta Você.
Só Falta Você.
Só Falta Você. Okay, here it is. Let's play a little bit.
Belo dia resolvi mudar e fazer tudo que eu queria fazer. Sei que eu nasci pra saber o quê.
Still popular, if you don't mind my mentioning, still wildly popular. Can you translate a little bit for us?
This one, Um belo dia resolvi. Oh, that's hard. Translate it up on the spot like that. One fine day, I just decided to change e fazer tudo que eu queria fazer and do everything that I wanted to do. And everything that I wanted to fazer. Me libertei daquela vida vulgar. Freed myself from that vulgar, kind of like mediocre life que eu levava estando junto a você, that I was living while with you. em tudo que eu faço. And in everything that I do, there is a why, there is a reason. Existe porquê, eu sei que eu nasci. I know that I was born. And then she repeats it.
You know what I like about this? I think a lot of other people like about this is it works. It's like both on a personal level and a bigger level. You
always.
Know? Right? Right?
Yes.
I mean,
I start on a personal level and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, this can work for something else too.
Exactly. This could have a lot of...
I am very personal in choosing my songs.
Well, what's the message here? What were you thinking then and what are you thinking now?
I've matured. I've grown. I'm independent. I don't need anything from, this person who's bullying and because, every now and again you meet somebody who can drag you down, They don't work for you. They work against you. And whether it's a person from an emotional kind of relationship or more personal, like family or whatnot, or political. Yeah, I like those that are, put your finger right in the face and say, yo, come on now.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with one of Brazil's most popular singers, Maria Rita. You mentioned something earlier about how it was too painful to listen to your mom's music for a long time now, and you can certainly see why. I mean, you lost her when you were like 4 years old. You're just four years old.
I was four.
Was it the fact of losing her, or was it how you lost her?
I didn't understand how I lost her until I was 13 years old. I read it in a book because nobody. I think nobody. I'm sorry to be so crude, but nobody had the guts to tell me.
Yeah. She died of an overdose, as I recall.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
And so they say. I mean, she did pass during the military dictatorship. So, nah. Yeah. Well, okay.
No, you make a valid point.
Another time we can talk about that.
I see your point.
Yeah. The doctor who signed the postmortem documentation was the same one. It was proved in the justice system that he was working for the dictator. So, I don't want to get into that now, but that's what it said. That's what it's known by now. So maybe someday we can investigate and look into it a little more. But for now, that's what it is. So I found out about it reading in a book. I was about 12 years old. I was alone in the house. My grandmother was watching because my dad had traveled with his wife for work. And I pretty much just threw the book against the wall, and I was so shocked. And my grandmother just steps in the room. That's my dad's mom. And we were really close. And I just looked at her, and I said, is this true? And she's like, yes, it is. And then she closes the door, kind of like telling me, deal with it in your own way. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Because it was a lot to take, This is the thing, having lost my mom when I was 4 years old, I don't really know what it's like to have a mother. So I miss something that I don't have, you see?
Yeah.
So it's this constant, I don't search for her, that's not the thing, but I feel like there's this little hole in my heart and it's forever going to be there because there's nothing that I can do. So I do therapy, I have no issues telling people that I'm in therapy. I've done therapy for the past 10 years. This whole pain, so to speak, I can deal with it now. So now it's easier for me to watch her and to listen to her.
What made it possible for you then? With that heaviness, I mean, I could understand it if you never wanted to touch the music that she sang.
Yeah.
I could understand. I mean, and you, frankly, you've had a great and are continuing to have a great career of your own, doing your own thing. So one could easily understand if you never wanted to put your hands on any of the music that she recorded. But then you did eventually an album of her music. What made it okay for you to do that? What did you want to?
Well, it was an homage, and I didn't allow anybody to make money out of it. Again, it's the opportunity to do something beautiful with no strings attached. And that would, early on in my career, that would just get me. I would be so upset whenever a TV show would, put it as a condition. You can only come here if you do your mom's music. And I'll be like, well, so I won't be going there. Thank you very much. Tough decisions, tough. But 10 years later, as you said, I got a number. I don't mean to sound obnoxious, of course, but that comes into play when you have a number of awards that, show you that you have some sort of recognition and respect from your peers, a number of albums sold and a fan base and tours that are, successful tours and traveling all over the country and all over the world to do what you want, to do what you love. It put me in the place where I felt more secure. I knew that I had already showed people and the press and whatnot that I've done my thing. So now I can sing for her, and I am able, with everything that I've conquered in my career, I am able to bring her to a generation who never knew her.
How did it feel doing the album? Was it
wonderful?
It felt good.
Wonderful. Oh, good. At the very beginning, well,
how? Like catharsis?
Yes. Yes, and it was such a wonderful thing to be up on stage as a daughter and not solely as a singer and see the reaction in people's faces. They would sing those songs. Those songs are hard. They're hard songs. They're not quite, you know, pop music where you can go do-do-do-da-da-da, you know. Mm-hmm. These are very complex melodically and harmonically, and the words, and everybody knows them to this day, and she's been gone for 32 mm-hmm. years now. It's very touching, and to see that she is alive.
I can see.
She is alive. She hasn't gone anywhere. And it touches me just by talking about it.
I see that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring up something.
No, it's quite all right. I feel proud.
Maria Hita is a Grammy Award-winning artist. She was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Thank you so much for speaking with us, and hope we'll speak again. Congratulations on everything. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, and hope to be back anytime soon.
And what song should we go out on? Pick any one of your four albums. What song would you like us to say goodbye to for now?
That's tough. Play Dos Cardenas.
Okay.
From the first album.
All right.
I guess.
Well, there it is.
Dos Cardenas para ti, con ellas quiero decir, te quiero, te adoro. Porque son tu corazón.